We're also joined by Rhode Island Public Radio political analyst Scott McKay. Hello, Scott.
Good morning, everyone.
Senator, you've expressed concern about how Rhode Island has more than $6 billion in outstanding state and local debt. As you've said, there always seems to be an attractive or necessary reason to borrow money. But considering this huge amount of debt, does it make sense that voters are being asked to borrow more than $200 million on the November ballot this year for a variety of purposes?
I think the items that are on the November ballot are very worthy causes that I think will contribute to our state's economy continuing to grow and continuing to improve. One of the things that I've defended, which I think would go part and parcel to future bond measures on the ballot, are for voters in the electorate and the General Assembly as well to look at, you know, what we have out there and to what are the limits of affordability. And you know, there's no one that's really looking in a comprehensive way. We look in a comprehensive way at general obligation.
What would you say of that? What are the limits of affordability? Is it $6 billion, $7 billion, $8
billion? I think at the end of the day, it depends on what the debt service costs represent as a percentage of your budget. And those parameters are established with general obligation debt, but we have more collective and aggregate quasi-public debt that's out there that's primarily supported by revenues. But my concern has always been that if something happens to go wrong, I mean, if you had another major economic debacle like we had in 2008, 2009, and people were not traveling over the Newport Bridge, and that impacted the Turnpike and Bridge revenues, and the airport passenger traffic plummeted, and there were a problem, the state would probably have to write a check to make sure that these entities didn't go into default. And so they're each viewed and reviewed individually, but nothing is being looked at comprehensively. And that's my concern, is to when you kind of take everything in, what can we afford and what are the safety valves, if you would, if something were to go wrong in one or more of these larger quasi-publics?
Let's go to Scott.
Given how well Bernie Sanders did here in the primary, and given the strong progressive vote in Rhode Island for Sanders, do you think the legislative leadership and the party establishment is out of touch with the party's more liberal base?
I think the Sanders movement, I think it's gotten the attention that, you know, there is a certain and sizable percentage of the electorate, the citizenry, that for a variety of reasons is not satisfied. And I think one of the things that we can probably do, always do a better job of, is listening to other opinions and have conversations. And when we can or have to agree to disagree, we can do so civilly. And not make it personal. And I think that's one of the advantages that I've seen and experienced in the Senate, is while we may have differences of opinion, you know, we can have frank, candid, informed discussions. But I do think that, you know, the apathy, the anger that may be out there is a time to focus and pay attention to what these concerns are, and try to reconcile to the extent possible the different points of view.
There's a lot of speculation about the future of Senate President Teresa Pivoweed. She looks like she's running for re-election, and she's told us that she hopes to win another term as Senate President next January. Do you think it's possible, if she does that she might hand off the presidency in a future term as president?
I don't know. I mean, obviously, you know, everything's possible. That's happened in a couple of House leaderships in the past. She has never expressed to me when she eventually would want to leave or retire or not run for re-election. So I think, again, you know, anything's possible. But I think she has been around long enough and is conscious enough to know, you know, when will be the appropriate time for her to move on.
In the realm of anything being possible, if Senate President Pivoweed leaves her office, would you be interested in succeeding her?
I'd certainly be interested, but I'd also have to see, you know, when that would happen in terms of timing and everything else, you know, going on. Being a part-time legislature, I've got a business to run as well. And so, you know, I'd really need to look at what the totality of the circumstances would be.
We're talking here with Senate Finance Chairman Daniel DuPont.
The legislature had yet another late night session, the sun coming up, slanting through the windows at the State House. Now, I know this is not unusual. I've covered legislatures in Providence, Boston, Montpelier, and the same thing happens occasionally. We know that it happens in Congress, but I'm wondering just the optics of this with the public and the fact that you have some older lawmakers in there. Is it really prudent to be staying up all night to do the public's work?
I don't think it's the preferred route. And I think that, you know, many of the things that end up getting passed at whatever late hour it may be, you know, they're all items, they're all policies that have really been worked on, you know, for a bulk of the session. Could we do more earlier on? Absolutely. But I think, again, it might be the human nature of folks are busy and there's a lot going on and they may, you know, not have time to introduce.
Yeah, look, I understand. You know, I've been to the mall on Christmas Eve and I've been to the post office on April 15th. But it just seems that there's so much wasted downtime in January and February and even March at the State House. And then you kind of like the college kid who's, you know, gone to parties all semester. And then, boy, you're staying up, you know, two nights in a row and pushing this stuff.
I think there have been years where we have, you know, finished early and we've done a lot more work, you know, earlier on. And so it's entirely possible because it's been done. And I think there just needs to be a conscious decision and a conscious effort on behalf of both leaderships to try to, you know, agree to pass more bills that are going to pass earlier on in the session.
Senator, were you surprised earlier this session when Senate President Paiva Weed put her support behind strengthening the Ethics Commission when for 7 years she had been seen as much less robust in her support of that measure, to put it diplomatically?
I'm not surprised. I think that there's always been a feeling, and you know, myself personally, contrary to what the Ethics Commission may say at times, I mean, I think they've always had, you know, oversight over legislators. I mean, you have to file your annual declarations, and
but they did not have the conflict of interest oversight since a Supreme Court ruling in 2009.
Well, I think it was specific to, you know, speech and debate and what that protects, your actions and your votes on the floor. But there's a whole variety of other actions and activity that would not be covered by speech and debate. And I think at the end of the day, you know, you can't legislate common sense. And we have a mechanism in place that if someone feels that they do have a conflict, you know, they have an obligation to recuse themselves and remove themselves from the debate and the discussion. And I think that's one point that was lost in a lot of this discussion and debate. Folks already had an obligation to use their good and common sense that if they saw a conflict, to, out of an abundance of caution, recuse themselves.
One of the big issues the Republicans are pushing is, of course, the truck toll measure. Now, do you think this is going to really be a large election issue this fall?
It may be. I'm not sure if the number of uncontested seats or even the platforms of the candidates that have declared to run against incumbents are going to make that.
How do your constituents feel about it? You're close to your constituents.
I got a lot of calls of folks that, you know, quite frankly, some folks thought that the tolls were going to apply to cars. They weren't even aware that it was specifically applying to a specific class of trucks. And the reality is, and as I've said earlier on, the infrastructure problem that we have has been 40 to 50 years in the making. And now the bill has come due, and it becomes not only an economic issue, but it's also a public safety issue. And of a variety of things that we've looked at as options to be able to fund it, this was the one that the administration and the General Assembly felt was the most appropriate.
The property tax is considered perhaps the most regressive tax in Rhode Island. East Providence, your home community, has enjoyed the benefits of some development in recent years. But I can tell you, as an East Providence homeowner, that property taxes have also continued to go up. What would it take to offer some tax relief on the property tax in communities like East Providence?
Well, it would certainly take resources. I mean, we had at one time the auto excise tax reimbursement program that cost the state $180 million in the last in general revenues in the last year that we before we phased it out. If the state had excess revenues, we could certainly revisit again, not a auto excise tax reimbursement program, but a direct tax relief program to property owners. And you could probably even carve it out to owner occupied properties. But again, you need the money to be able to do that.
We're out of time, so we have to leave it there. Thanks for joining us, Scott.
Great to be here.
And State Senator Daniel DuPont, Chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, Democrat of East Providence.
Thank you very much.